From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, uproar over Russia and the U.S. elections. ExxonMobil's chief tapped as Secretary of State, slaughter in Aleppo. President Obama told NPR there will be retaliation against Russia for meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
There is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham raised red flags on President-elect Donald Trump's choice of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State.
My question, Mr. Tillerson, do you realize what Russia's up to here and all over the world, and are you willing to do something about it? Do you support new sanctions? And if he doesn't, I'd be very hard for me to vote for him.
And as resistance collapses in Aleppo, one Syrian woman, activist Lina Alshami, went to Twitter to say goodbye.
To everyone who can hear me, we are here exposed to a genocide in the busy city of Aleppo. This may be my last video.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Brennan, Reed Wilson, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you read the CIA's contention that Russia intervened for Donald Trump? And what now? And where are you on Rex Tillerson, Rick Perry, the polar vortex out there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Brennan, foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, Reed Wilson, national political correspondent for The Hill. Reed, great to have you here.
Hey, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Reed.
Early in the week, Donald Trump was very clear with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday about what he thought of the CIA's contention that Russia was all over the U.S. elections on his behalf.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it. I don't know why. And I think it's just, they talked about all sorts of things. Every week it's another excuse.
But the heat has grown all week long on MSNBC. Yesterday, California Senator Dianne Feinstein, she's on the Senate Intelligence Committee vice chair there, had this to say about the Russian hacking in the U.S. presidential election.
This is, in my view, a real attack at our system of election, democratic election. And I don't think our country can just stand by and let this happen, because once it happens, it's open sesame.
And then yesterday, President Obama sat down with NPR's Steve Inskeep, said we have to take action.
We need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized. Some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it.
Margaret Brennan, what kind of retaliation might the U.S. take against Russia over this assertion that Russia and Mr. Putin himself directly interfered in the U.S. presidential election?
Well, when President Obama confronted Vladimir Putin about this hacking for the first time back in September when the two met in China, the president said he made clear the U.S. has a vast capability to defend and to attack via cyber. But what he also said is he doesn't want this to escalate into a cyber war. What we know are that White House officials have been debating what would be the correct way, the best way to retaliate for months. They are considering sanctions on high-level Russian intelligence officers. They've also looked at some of those retaliatory, perhaps proportional cyber attacks. But just what proportional means here isn't clear.
I mean, Reed Wilson, part of what's proportional depends on how big a blow you think this was to the presidential election, the good order of it, the sort of free and fair quality of it. What's your sense of is there a Washington consensus on this? Are people as all over the map as Donald Trump and Barack Obama are at this point? You know, was this a dire offense against our core exercise of democracy?
Well, what I think is most notable and probably scariest about this whole thing is that we now have our intelligence communities in a sort of a politicized state. We've got Donald Trump, the Republican president-elect, openly questioning the CIA and the conclusion that it has drawn. And then in the Washington Post today, we've got an op-ed from John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, questioning the integrity of the FBI. This is not a good thing. This is not a good place for America to be at the moment in a moment where even our most trusted institutions are becoming politicized and being questioned. To Margaret's earlier point, though, when we talk about a proportional response, we have to remember that we as Americans have a lot more on the line than Russians do. You know, the American intelligence community is in the Russian systems as much as we are, but there's less at stake in Russia because, you know, we have so many of our infrastructure and so much of our energy programs that are all online. You know, whether it's
isn't it the same there?
I don't know about that, but the fact is they are able to those sort of cyber intrusions. What American intelligence community has been worried about for a long time is a cyber attack that takes down an electrical grid, a water system, something like that in America. That's the escalation that we're all worried about.
Margaret, are we playing here? I mean, the president sounds very sober, but are we toying with war?
Well, the White House has said it's not an act of warfare here. They take it, though, extremely seriously. They don't want it to escalate into cyber warfare. The thing, though, that has really led to so many delays here, not only President Obama's contention that he didn't want to come out and look like he was politicizing intelligence by saying and really ringing the bells loudly before the election. Ironically, that's what he's being accused of doing now. Though he did make clear in October by ordering the National Intelligence Director to release a statement saying they really believed that it was high levels of the Russian government behind some of these election-related hacks. So it's sort of this argument within the administration. Do you carry out sanctions? Those are punitive. They're not prohibitive. You can punish, but you don't stop them from doing it again. How do you hit back in a way that doesn't continue to escalate? And President Obama is sure to be asked about this and his thinking on it later today when he gives what is expected to be his last presidential news conference of 2016.
Jack Beatty, this goes to one's assessment of the seriousness of what happened in this presidential campaign season, in the election. I mean, if indeed, as the CIA seems to be saying, this was direct interference on behalf of one candidate with consequences – that went all the way to the top of the Russian government, to Vladimir Putin himself. I mean, you can see what a kind of a swivet this campaign got into at a certain point. If this is the way it's going to be down the road, how do you maintain the seriousness, the sobriety, the even keel of the American political system? On the other hand, if you say this is a dire offense and go hard at Russia, where does that take us?
That could take us into full-out cyber war with the kinds of consequences we've just heard about. It's an unprecedented situation. An aspect of this is, what is Donald Trump's connection with Russia? I mean, he's insulted. The New York Times had a double-paged, full-page, double spread, two pages, of insults and tweets and insulting statements that Trump made pretty much about every person you can think of, and even some different species. I mean, it went from the Pope to Angela Merkel to Megyn Kelly. One exception, Vladimir Putin. Consistently, he has gone out of his way to praise him, extenuate his some things he's done, even the shooting down of the Dutch airliner. Why? Vanity? We do know that that Putin flattered him. He said he was colorful. Of course, Trump said that meant he was a genius. It wasn't. Financial ties? Well, you know, in 2008, Donald Trump Jr. said this: Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of our assets. Is there some financial tie there? Will there be a quid pro quo because of the help that Russia gave him? Will that quid pro quo take the form of lifting sanctions? Is Tillerson himself quid pro quo? Will there be, on the Russian side, hotels in Moscow? We don't know. But the point is, the president will be, in 34 days, Donald Trump takes office with this cloud hanging over him.
Reid, how does Washington come to some – is this just a matter of Obama will do what he does in those 30-plus days, and then it's the Trump administration, and this is over because he's very friendly with Moscow? Or
no,
is there a strong sense on Capitol Hill that this has to be deeply investigated, honestly investigated, with potential consequence? Could Donald Trump just shut that down as president?
No, Donald Trump cannot shut down a congressional hearing, and there are going to be congressional hearings on this. Whether it ends with, you know, the Rex Tillerson Secretary of State nomination, I don't believe it will. I think that we're going to see investigations from the Senate Armed Services Committee, from the intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House. You played a clip at the top from Senator Lindsey Graham, Senator John McCain, and Senator Marco Rubio, who lost to Donald Trump, of course, in the Republican primaries, all have voiced concerns over this. And in regards to Rex Tillerson's nomination, but you can anticipate that this is not going to go away for a long time, as long as Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and Marco Rubio, three Republicans, by the way, keep this alive.
I mean, how do we think about our own elections down the road if every 4 years, or maybe more often, you've got the potential for serious intervention from abroad that potentially substantially shifts or discombobulates the American electorate?
Tom, let me make a quick point about that. It's important to remember that let's assume that the Russians were in fact behind these hacks. The hacks were not of election systems. They were not of the actual vote counting and vote tabulation.
So what? It got right in the heart of our debate. It got right in the heart of our campaign season.
However, it is important to remember for the integrity of the election process going forward that the Russians were not changing actual votes.
Yeah, we know that, but this is what they do with little neighboring countries all over Eastern Europe, and now they're doing it with the United States of America, Reid.
Yes, but there's a difference between actually hacking into the real machines that count the actual votes and hacking into the Democratic National Committee.
Of course, but is it different in terms of interfering? It's interference either way.
Sure. That was not my point. My point was the integrity of the actual vote counting process is separate from the integrity of the entire campaign and the entire election process.
Of course, that vote grows out of the campaign season, and that's where the interference is asserted here. I want to come back and look at that with our listeners. Reid Wilson with The Hill, please stand by there in Washington. Margaret Brennan with CBS News. It's great to have you here. Jack Beatty, listeners, you can join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Russia and the U.S. vote, Aleppo horror. ExxonMobil's chief as Secretary of State, polar vortex, big chill all over the place lately. Margaret Brennan is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Reid Wilson is here, national political correspondent for The Hill. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What about how do we have free and fair elections in this country if we can allegedly so easily be toyed with by hackers? Or do you believe Donald Trump, that the whole thing, the whole assertion is ridiculous? What do you make of the latest Trump nominees, Exxon's Tillerson for Secretary of State, Rick Perry at Energy, and what are we witnessing this week in Aleppo, Syria? Callers, let's bring them. New York, Sue's calling from Whiteham's, New York. Sue, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say I want the investigation to go beyond a bipartisan independent commission, just looking into the Russian hacking. I want to know exactly what the Trump-Russian connection is. Trump has said, I have nothing to do with Russia. I have zero investments in Russia. His son has stated otherwise, saying we see a lot of money pouring in from Russia. There isn't a bank in the United States that would have given him a loan based on six bankruptcies.
I don't know about that. He's done business for a long time. But you want to know what Jack's alluding to here is, are there other ties with Russia?
Yeah, I mean, he already has a connection with a Russian billionaire named Agalarov, who helped finance the beauty pageant in Russia. And there was a preliminary deal on the table to build in Russia with the same person, except that it was put on hold, and this is according to Agalarov, so that Trump could run for president.
Sue, let us pick it up. Pick it up right here. Margaret Brennan, will we have transparency about Donald Trump's ties to Russia when he takes office as president of the United States?
Well, there's a lot of work being cut out for not just investigators, but investigative reporters in Washington who are going to be covering the Trump White House. What we know is that there will be some financial disclosures that have to be made sometime following inauguration. But we haven't gotten the full accounting of Trump's own finances, as he hasn't released them in full form himself. So there are a lot of questions there. But what we're getting to more broadly, though, is this demand for unimpeachable fact And that's sort of what's at the question of this debate, mm-hmm. as you have this CIA report that was shared privately with elected members of Congress that said the CIA's assessment, and that's what the CIA does, it assesses, it comes to a judgment that Russia did, in fact, interfere with the election. So there's going to be a lot more pressure on the Obama administration in these final days to get the National Intelligence Community to come out with a final cohesive, singular idea here as to what exactly happened. Now, keep in mind, there are about 17 different intelligence agencies. They haven't all come to the conclusion that the CIA shared with Capitol Hill. But what they did say back in October, that to some degree, Russia was intervening to interfere.
But they're well beyond that now. They've said with high confidence is the language they're talking now. And they're even leaking that it goes all the way to Vladimir Putin himself. This is not a broad general assertion anymore, is it, Margaret?
From the director of national intelligence, we haven't heard anything since October. That's when they gave that broad assessment. The CIA report that we're talking about that's new just in the past few days hasn't been made public. So there's pressure to release that. And that's what the administration is trying to do, get information that it can fully disclose to the public so there can be an accounting. Some of that, though, may not come until the new Congress and that move into a full congressional hearing. But until you get some real facts disclosed that the public can look at and judge, if they believe the intelligence community, as Donald Trump is now telling them not to do, you're going to continue to have this kind of misinformation.
Well, I don't know what's misinformation here. I mean, the president himself yesterday, I mean, take it or leave it, but he, talking with Steve Inskeep, I mean, he said, you know, when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, we need to take action, and we will. I mean, the more than implication there is that that's settled, that intervention did happen. And he told him he's already intending, he's planning to take some kind of action before Donald Trump takes office. Brian in Lexington, Kentucky. Brian, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I think this is just all a bunch of post-election drama. I think Russia and ourselves share some joint commitments in the world, and we need to focus on what's important. I don't think America should be wasting CIA assets or lives in Syria. I think we should be working hand-in-hand with Putin. He's not a dumb guy. He knows what's going on over there. He has good relationships with Syria. And as far as that goes, sometimes you have to support the lesser two evils. If you get rid of if you change a government in Syria, you may usher in something even worse. So I think we need to look at moving ahead, getting over the
Brian, I get that. And we'll look at Syria, but what about the changing of the government in this country? I mean, look down the road. And if we've got foreign governments coming in and hacking in and messing in American elections every time we go, let's say, for the top office in the land, look down the road. How does that play out? I mean, this perhaps you're supported Donald Trump, fine, and perhaps you're pleased that he won, fine. But what if next time it's a candidate you don't support and some foreign government comes in a significant way and bends the election against your candidate, Brian? What do you think?
Well, I think there's other things going on in the world. I mean, you've seen riots break out in America. Sometimes that's politically or religiously motivated, and sometimes that's people trying to interfere in the process here in the United States. I honestly don't think Russia did anything harmful to the United States. I think they should be a closer friend of ours in the future.
Brian, I've got it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Reed Wilson, how about it?
This is one of the things I mentioned earlier. We're talking about the politicization of things that used to not be terribly political. YouGov, the polling firm, came out with a survey this week that showed that Vladimir Putin's image among Republican voters especially has gone from really, really unfavorable to just a little bit unfavorable, whereas – you know, and over the span of the 6 months or so that since Donald Trump became the Republican nominee, that tells you that, you know, even American foreign policy, remember that old line, politics ends at the water's edge, that's no longer the case. And we are dealing with a new reality where not only are foreign actors trying to be involved in American political campaigns, but where things like American foreign policy and our relationship with a country that is clearly a rival of ours around the world is now a political debate and up for up to the interpretations of partisans on the right and the left.
I mean, Jack, you don't want to go to war, maybe not even cyber war. On the other hand, our country's foundation is on having some kind of free and fair election every so often. And when it turns out to be so easy to get in there and, you know, fool around with it, how do we maintain the legitimacy of that?
Well, the president is speaking of introducing a kind of new regime about cyber espionage and, quote, cyber warfare. And he hopes somehow to reach some kind of international understanding, but not before he retaliates. And what form that will take, we don't know. But it seems as if that retaliation is necessary to put on the board, in Mr. Putin's mind, the prospect that there could be more and worse. And when you look at Putin, you know, he is likely to be the richest man in the world. Estimates are, I think, our government estimates $82 billion. His salary is $167,000 a year. He is a kleptocrat. He has plundered his own economy. He is vulnerable to publicity within Russia on that. He may be vulnerable to his funds may be impoundable in some places. The point is, he's personally vulnerable. And if he was personally behind the decisions to, if not to start the hacking, then to deploy how it was affecting the election, this could be an intimate strike at Mr. Putin.
This goes then to the Secretary of State nominee, talking Rex Tillerson here. Donald Trump out of the box here. The CEO of ExxonMobil, the biggest oil company in the world, will be the man he offers up to be United States Secretary of State on Fox News Sunday. He said, hey, Rex Tillerson is more than just a businessman.
He's a world-class player. He's in charge of, I guess, the largest company in the world. He's in charge of an oil company that's pretty much double the size of his next nearest competitor. It's been a company that's been unbelievably managed. And to me, a great advantage is he knows many of the players, and he knows them well. He does massive deals in Russia. He does massive deals for the company, not for himself.
Massive deals. Senator John McCain, not so crazy necessarily about Rex Tillerson. Here was the Republican senator talking with CNN.
I will make no judgment until the hearing takes place and the questions are answered and we go through the process. But anybody who's a friend of Vladimir Putin must disregard the fact that Vladimir Putin is a murderer, a thug, a KGB agent, and I don't see how anybody could be a friend of this old-time KGB agent.
Margaret Brennan, what do you expect when Rex Tillerson comes before Congress for the Senate for these hearings?
Sure. Just real quick fact check there on the president-elect. ExxonMobil is not the largest corporation in the world necessarily. It is America's largest oil company. And Rex,
it's not
Tillerson,
the world's largest oil company? I believe it is.
Well, he said world's largest company, period.
Uh-huh.
That's why I was correcting you to oil company.
Mm-hmm.
But Rex Tillerson at the helm of that certainly does have very deep relationship with countries and leaders all around the world, some of them with very difficult human rights records, Angola, Chad, Russia, etc. So it's a very different thing to go from brokering deals to being a diplomat where, at least up to this point, American values have been articulated as also protecting human rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, all the things that all of our secretaries of state go to other capitals and advocate for. At the same time, they're arguing for America's more material national interest. So it's going to be interesting to get Rex Tillerson in that seat where he's got to answer a lot of tough questions that, frankly, the president-elect who appointed him has not yet been fully questioned on. It is interesting, and I heard that from one of your callers just moments ago, that idea, you know, in the past, standing by the U.S. military, standing by national security officials was viewed as an apolitical judgment. It was viewed as patriotic. Now we're talking about the Pentagon being hacked, the State Department being hacked, the White House having been hacked. You've got this CIA assessment now being questioned by some of the American public. Vladimir Putin, at a minimum, has to be glad to know that some people in America trust his word more than that of the United States national security officials. It's a very bizarre situation to be in. But Rex Tillerson, many Republicans on Capitol Hill say they really want to flesh out exactly what his financial relationship has been with Vladimir Putin. But they are hopeful that because he is viewed as a very smart, very savvy adult, mm-hmm. that he will put American interests first and not simply be cutting transactions, instead being strategic.
Reed Wilson, traditionally, American interests included concern about democracy, human rights. We basically never hear Donald Trump talk about those things. Maybe that's not what he wants from this Secretary of State.
Well, one of the things that has struck me as Donald Trump has put together his cabinet is that the cabinet has much more sort of solid platform positions on whatever departments they're planning to run than the president-elect himself seems to have. Donald Trump does not come into office with the 500 or 600 pages of policy prescriptions that a normal president-elect would bring to office. He didn't really articulate those on the campaign trail, and he hasn't fleshed out a notion for what he wants to do in his first 100 days or his first four-year term. So when somebody like, forget Rex Tillerson, look at the number two deputy that they're thinking about naming, John Bolton, the former UN ambassador, he has very strong feelings about the Iran deal, about America's relationship with the United Nations. Rick Perry, the nominee to be the energy secretary, the Energy Department was one of the departments that Perry wanted to get rid of. As a matter of fact, it was the one he forgot when he was listing those in that debate. Take a look at Scott Pruitt, the nominee to be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. He's been fighting the EPA for years. So these are the conservative dream team, if you will, in a cabinet that is being led by somebody who doesn't have a lot of direction on these specific policy issues. So I think you're going to see these cabinet members, after a few presidents in a row taking power away from the cabinet, I think you're going to see the cabinet being a lot more powerful in this administration than it has been in decades.
Which means the people on it matter. John in Richmond, Vermont. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm just struck by the decentralization of this. Your panel talked about the cabinet having power. He's allowing himself to be able to change and change direction if he wants to, if somehow the wind blows in the opposite direction. My concern is that he's trying to determine what the facts are, and the accountability goes the other way. He has to prove to the American electorate and elected officials that he's operating on facts that are verifiable.
We'll see what he gets from his cabinet. Reed Wilson suggesting that maybe this will be a more powerful cabinet than usual. On the other hand, Donald Trump doesn't seem a guy that wants to be overruled much by much of anybody. We'll see, John. Leah in Atlanta, Georgia. You're on, Leah.
Yes, I was wondering how many of these cabinet positions will actually be confirmed, considering that a lot of these people seem to be at odds with what cabinet they would represent, basically.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, can the Senate do something about confirmations for cabinet members who are obviously unsuited for to run the agencies that they're supposed to run?
I mean, so you say, but Donald Trump says these are the guys that I want, and they may well line up and support him in that. Reed?
She brings up an interesting point, though, because when cabinets come in or when presidents get to nominate a whole bunch of new people all at one time, say they get elected to a second term, typically in recent years, the opposition party has picked one or two people to concentrate their fire on. Democrats have big objections to Betsy DeVos, the nominee to be the head of the Education Department, to Ben Carson and his experience or lack thereof heading the Housing and Urban Development. But are Democrats going to sit there and try to filibuster or oppose every single one of Trump's nominees? No, they're not. They've got to pick a few. And there's a little bit of strategy here, I imagine, in offering up a few nominees who are obviously going to be flashpoints in order to protect some other nominees who, in a normal case, would have been the flashpoints themselves.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. And as they go into their own issues of transparency, what we may learn there about their connections. Rex Tillerson, I mean, head of ExxonMobil, how's he going to disentangle from that? Reed Wilson, please stand by in Washington with The Hill. Margaret Brennan with CBS News. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Stephen Colbert had fun with the meeting between President-elect Donald Trump and Kanye West in Trump Tower.
Now, obviously, meeting like this, it's a security risk. Gathering the two most powerful American narcissists in the same room. So, you can't do it.
Actor Alan Thicke died Tuesday at the age of 69. He played the dad, Jason Seaver, on the sitcom Growing Pains.
Yeah, but he sat not 3 feet away from me, and he said, Dad, I swear it, I'm ready for total responsibility.
Jason, you are not ready for total responsibility.
And Hollywood musical La La Land dominates the Golden Globe nominations. Here's star Ryan Gosling.
City of stars, are you shining just for me?
We're looking at a week in the news, Russia and the U.S. vote, Aleppo horror, ExxonMobil's chief as Secretary of State, the polar vortex over much of the northern U.S., and more. Margaret Brennan is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Reed Wilson is here, national political correspondent for The Hill. Our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. How do you assess what we're seeing in Aleppo this week? And what are you thinking on Ohio's abortion ban after 20 weeks? On the EPA saying fracking can contaminate water supplies? On Yahoo's giant hack, Facebook's moves on fake news, resistance kind of collapsing in Aleppo this week under heavy, heavy attack from Syrian and Russian military. On Wednesday, the Syrian military and its allies released this footage of bombing in eastern Aleppo. And U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Power, sitting before the U.N. Security Council, called out the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran for their relentless assault, she said, on Syrian civilians.
It should shame you. Instead, by all appearances, it is emboldening you. You are plotting your next assault. Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit?
Margaret Brennan, has the resistance in Aleppo essentially collapsed? What does that mean for the civil war in Syria?
Well, as one European official put it to me, Aleppo has effectively fallen. All this debate has been about what direction it falls in. What he meant by that is John Kerry and others have basically been trying to minimize the bloodshed. John Kerry yesterday took to the podium at the State Department to make one last plea, really echoing some of what Samantha Power, the ambassador, just said, comparing the slaughter, what he called the unrelenting massacre underway in Syria, in Aleppo right now, to the 1995 Srebrenica genocide. That is powerful imagery. He used it intentionally. Unfortunately, that rhetoric, that shame, as Samantha Power put it, is all that the U.S. is able to do or willing to do right now under the Obama administration. What we know is that from European and U.S. diplomats is that there's been a pocket of besieged Aleppo where they estimate about 30,000 civilians have been holed up. Mixed in those civilian areas, there are fighters. About 9,000 as of last week were estimated to be among them. And separating them out and then separating out those who are classified or qualified as extremists has been what the Russians say they haven't seen the U.S. deliver on. But what European and American officials will tell you is that it's the Shiite militias backed by Iran, along with Iranian advisors themselves, who are on the ground with a very weak Syrian Assad loyal military who are actually carrying out what they call door-to-door slaughter. And some of those evacuated convoys that John Kerry talked about and acknowledged as progress yesterday, he also noted they'd seen convoys with civilians fired upon and men of fighting age between 18 and 40 simply going missing after being allowed out of the city. So I think it's very clear to most humanitarian organizations, certainly to the United Nations, what is underway in Aleppo right now. For those, including some of your callers, who've articulated this idea that perhaps the U.S. should put those atrocities aside and align with Russia, I would point to the very hard-to-swallow statistic from the State Department that they say 80 to 85% of Russian airstrikes in Syria have been on civilian areas where rebels backed by the U.S. have been. They are not fighting ISIS in the view of the United States government.
Margaret, you've reported that Arab diplomats are telling you that they're persuaded that Russia and Iran and Syria are doing whatever it takes, including the slaughter you've reported, to win before in Aleppo, maybe beyond, before Donald Trump takes office. Why would they care? Donald Trump doesn't seem too concerned about the human rights angle, as far as I can tell.
Well, it's interesting. Just last night, Donald Trump said at a rally in Pennsylvania, the first time since he's been elected, that he actually does want to establish a safe zone in Syria, or at least help to establish one.
Okay.
Not clear exactly what that will mean. That's a bit of a shift because you're right. Up to this point, he said he wants to align with Russia and said, well, you know, basically align with the strongman at whatever cost it is to the kind of slaughter that we've seen the civilians who are on the receiving end. So it's really not clear what the policy is going to be yet. But you're right. It wouldn't necessarily make logical sense. But what we know from American diplomats, European diplomats, is they believe that Russia's calculation here is just clean it up, be able to declare victory, help Assad to solidify control so that then they can start with a new administration in a true position of strength, having held now the second largest city, one of the largest cities, I should say, Aleppo in Syria. Of course, that is a Pyrrhic victory at best for Bashar al-Assad, as he has created millions of homeless people and refugees from his own people in that what he calls victory of reclaiming Aleppo with the help of Russia and with Iran.
Half of Syria's population displaced. Shoaib in Lumberton, North Carolina. Shoaib, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I want to talk about there are different reports coming out from Russia Today and Press TV, which are contradictory to what we are hearing over here. But what is common between all these stories is that they are civilians who are in need of our help, and instead of people focusing on who did what, because a lot of times what happens is we hear the correct story a couple of months down the road or weeks down the road, but right now what is common is the civilians who need our help, and people should be focusing more on that. I mean, not you guys are discussing that's important, but also the people should also remember the people who are in need of help, people, refugees in camps and trying to get out of the town.
I mean, clearly there's a lot of need right there, and there's been a lot of efforts to assist, and there's been a lot that hasn't been done as well. I appreciate your call. Should we have one more on this Aleppo front? Jim in Kent, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I watched RT last night, and I was really struck by the joy of the people who felt that they were liberated by the Syrian military and Russia from the terrorists who were occupying their city for so long. And I'm just struck by the contrast between Aleppo and Mosul in Iraq, you know, where you have cities who are taken over by terrorist groups, and in one sense, you know, they're being liberated, according to our news, in Mosul, but they're being oppressed and bombarded in Aleppo. Well, I believe that there are terrorist groups on both in both cities and elsewhere, of course, and that any fight against those terrorists is a good fight.
Jim, I appreciate your call. Margaret Brennan, we're in a new age here. Jim's getting his news from RT, Russian television there, presenting this as the liberation of Aleppo. What about it? I mean, can we just fairly say that this is a slaughter? We heard earlier in the hour tape from a Syrian woman saying it's genocide. Are there really conflicting, truthfully conflicting interpretations of what's going on here? Jim says, well, how's it so different from what U.S.-backed forces are doing in Mosul?
I would caution Jim to be really careful and make sure that he really trusts his news sources and be mindful of the fact that many U.S. officials have characterized RT as a propaganda arm of the Russian government. I'm not saying that. That is what other U.S. officials have said. So I would say don't think it's necessarily neutral, just as you wouldn't necessarily believe that U.S. government-funded publications are going to be neutral. Putting that aside, I would say if you want to look at what is nominally and many would say verifiably a neutral party here, that is its very mandate, look at what the United Nations has said about what is happening in Aleppo. It basically said, you know, humanity has been abandoned. What is happening on the ground there? That is very, very brutal door-to-door killing. They actually have raised the issue of door-to-door killing underway in Aleppo of civilians. That is not the U.S. government. That is not the Russian government. That is the international community. And so I would point your listener to that particular report to try to get a sense of what those on the ground are saying.
One more on this front. Mike in Greenville, South Carolina. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, hey, Tom. I couldn't agree more with your panelist on RT. But mainly, you know, the point I wanted to make was in regards to Syria. You know, if we're going to have an honest discussion on it, you know, we need to kind of look back at what our president did in drawing the red line and then effectually backing off from it. And to hear Samantha Powers and John Kerry so boisterously denounce the international community and their inaction, it's laughable that you know, our own country failed to intervene, and our own president didn't stay resolute in his convictions when he drew that red line. And I think that's really one of the sources of we could have prevented a lot of the deaths had we followed through on that threat or on that red line.
Margaret Brennan, fair critique there?
It's hard to do these counterfactual arguments, but what I will say is your listener there is bringing up a really interesting point and something that we really didn't hear articulated by either of the two presidential candidates on the campaign trail is whether or not the United States still believes in a responsibility to protect, that as the world superpower, as the power that sets the global agenda, whether it's at the UN or elsewhere, that we believe that it is a fundamental human right and certainly at the core of American values to prevent mass slaughter. That slogan, never again, that was repeated mm-hmm. after the Holocaust, that was repeated after Rwanda, that was repeated after Srebrenica, that we haven't heard a full fleshing out of why in this case it is not in U.S. interests to intervene, to stop the slaughter that has caused a massive refugee crisis that U.S. officials say has destabilized Europe, that European officials say has really led to a backlash there and destabilized their politics, that there has left a vacuum there that terrorists have filled in the form of ISIS and al-Qaeda. So on a moral basis, you could have made the argument for intervention. On a national security basis, there were many who made the argument for intervention. And on a practical basis, there were people like John Kerry, the Secretary of State, who privately and never successfully made the argument that his diplomacy would actually be more effective if it was backed up by the threat of the credible use of force. Mm. So there is definitely something that historians who will, many say, look very harshly back at this period of time for the international community doing nothing to stop it and for them to debate.
Red lines ignored, moral lines maybe ignored. We're going to look at exactly that around Syria and Aleppo right here on Monday in this hour. Can we turn to the trial of Dylann Roof, found guilty, convicted this week in the killing of those 9 black church members, of course, in Charleston, South Carolina in June last year. Sharon Risher's mother was killed during the attack, and she said afterwards she wants the jury to keep this message in mind when they determine Roof's punishment.
I want them to be able to send a message for anybody else out there that has an agenda that comes from hate, that it won't be tolerated in America.
Reed Wilson, what about the message of the Dylann Roof trial this week? He wanted to represent himself, and he's done that. He said he wanted to start a race war in this country. The first reaction was Charleston was proud of this, much more about love and healing. And yet, during the week of this trial, and as we heard once again, just how horrible it was there, this is an ugly, ugly thing to have out in front of the whole country.
And it is a conversation that's coming up more and more. We have a race problem in this country in which the communities that live next door to each other do not speak to each other, do not trust each other, don't trust the authorities and the police. And this is society-wide. It's not just something that is happening in a courtroom in South Carolina. And it's something that we're going to have to deal with over the next decade, over the next generation. This is troubling. It's something that I think is pervasive across society. It came up during the political campaign that has just passed and is not likely to go away anytime soon. I wish I had a solution. I don't think I do.
2 hours. He's guilty. We'll see what the punishment is. Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Our time is short, Bill. You're on the air.
You got it. Thanks so much. It's unfortunate that the racial issue is still ongoing, that the legal system is so tedious and even reflects the media, and the media is accurate. However, I think what we should do is start educating from day one of a young person's education about the history of, I mean, really explain the history of prejudice and all the way through college. We see on very bright college campuses where there's prejudice that exists from enlightened people. So it's going to follow through with the legal system and the political system. Education, as is most fields, is the secret, I believe.
Well, we hope there's some right there in the Dylann Roof verdict, but tragedy for Charleston and for the whole country to watch that. And Rita, I wanted to ask you about Janet Yellen this week, the Fed hiking rates just a little bit, but is she on a collision course ultimately with Donald Trump? He wants to maybe, you know, juice up infrastructure spending, stimulus for the economy. The Fed seems to be looking more at, pretty low unemployment and the possibility of inflation. Are they lining up to bump into each other?
Yet another non-political institution that is becoming politicized. Janet Yellen's most interesting thing that she said yesterday is she expects 3 rate hikes next year, or at least rate hikes of 75 basis points, probably in 25-point increments.
Well, who says it's politicized? She's doing her job, right?
Oh, the president-elect is politicizing the Fed, which has previously not been politicized. One of the things that really struck me yesterday was a Republican congressman from Texas who had previously been insisting that the Fed raise rates was now being skeptical of the fact that the Fed is raising rates. So there we go. Yet another institution that used to be off limits for politics is now in the middle of our political debate.
Wow. Everything pulled in. Speaking of polar vortex, there's some kind of new political vortex here. Very grateful to all of you for being with us this hour. Reed Wilson at The Hill. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Reed.
You got it, Tom.
Margaret Brennan with CBS News. So appreciate your reporting and your time today. Thank you very much for being with us, Margaret.
It's been fun.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always for joining us. Stay warm.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.